Chapter 5. A London Gentleman. In London, I took a coach to Mr. Jagger's office, noticing along the way how crowded and dirty the city was and how badly it smelled. Just as I arrived, I saw Jagger's coming up the street. Several clients who had been waiting rushed at him. He handled them quickly, asking, "Did you pay Wemmick?" and threatening to give up their cases if they did not move on. Then he took me inside and told me the arrangements as he scrubbed his hands with scented soap. I was given a generous allowance and was to stay at Mr. Herbert Pocket's house until Monday. After that, Herbert would take me to his father's apartment. Jaggers then introduced me to Mr. Wemmick, his clerk, who showed me the way to Herbert's apartment. As we left the building, clients ran after Wemmick, but he dismissed them as quickly as Jaggers had. He had small, dark, intelligent eyes and a thin mouth, but he was pleasant enough, pointing out stores and warning me about thieves and cheats. We arrived at an old, dirty building and he said goodbye. I knocked at the door of an apartment on the second floor. After a minute, the door was opened by a cheerful, pale-faced, freckled man. I recognized him immediately, but before I could say a word, he led me in and showed me my bedroom and the rest of the little apartment. Finally, his mouth fell open. "I know you. You're the boy from Miss Havisham's. And you're the pale young gentleman who likes fighting." We burst out laughing then. Sitting down, we talked and shared our stories, and I found Herbert extremely friendly, open, and honest about everything he thought. Over dinner, I asked about Estella. "That girl's hard and proud," he said. "Miss Havisham adopted her and raised her to take revenge on all men." When I asked what he meant, he told me Miss Havisham's story. She had a half-brother, but when her father had died about 25 years before, he had left most of his money to her. Her half-brother had been extremely jealous and angry. He had disappeared and had not been heard of since. Not long after, she fell deeply in love with a man who pretended to be a gentleman, but was not. "My father," Herbert explained, "says any man who's not a true gentleman at heart isn't a gentleman at all. No amount of acting can hide someone's true nature." However, Miss Havisham was so in love that she was blind to the man's true nature, and he got huge amounts of money out of her. All of her relatives were after her money too, so no one dared say anything, afraid she'd get upset, except my father, who warned her. She got so angry at him, she ordered him out of the house, and my father hasn't seen her since. On the morning of the wedding, Herbert continued, the man didn't arrive. Instead, he sent a letter. "That arrived at 9:20? I asked. "Exactly," nodded Herbert. "And then she stopped all the clocks. She became extremely sick, and when she recovered, she had the house boarded up as it is now. She hasn't looked upon the light of day since." "So that's the whole story?" I asked. "I've forgotten one thing, that people guessed the man was working with her half-brother, and they shared the profits. I wonder why he didn't marry her and get all the property. If people guess he was already married, and the cruelness of the plan was part of her half-brother's scheme," said Herbert. "So when was Estella adopted then?" Herbert shrugged, saying, "There's always been an Estella since I've known Miss Havisham." After this, I told Herbert about my benefactor, and he promised to keep my secret. Then I asked what he did, and he said he was in the shipping business. Impressed, I asked how many ships he had. "Well, none yet," he said. He explained that for now he was just a clerk at a company. "But one day a door will open, and I'll find my chance." He was so cheerful that I smiled, but I wondered how he could dream like that. Herbert showed me all around the city that weekend. Then on Monday, he took me to his parents' house. Matthew Pocket, Herbert's father, had a very natural, unaffected way about him, and I felt comfortable with him immediately. He showed me my room, and that night I met his two other students, Drummle, a proud, unpleasant young man who didn't smile at all, and Startop, a bright, friendly fellow whom I got along with well. After some discussion, we decided I would split my time between this house and living with Herbert in town. So I began my life in London, studying with Mr. Pocket and spending my free time with Herbert and Startop rowing on the river and getting to know the city. Herbert was also kind enough to coach me in table manners. I was very grateful to him. I realized from the beginning how lucky I was to have so quickly made such kind, honest friends. While I studied hard, driven by my desire to not be common, I also began to spend money. I started going to gentlemen's clubs and decorating the apartment in unnecessary, expensive ways that I thought were more suitable to a gentleman. Herbert happily accompanied me to the clubs, although he did not have the money for it. Even so, he refused to accept any from me. One afternoon, I went to see Wemmick for more money. Mr. Jagger's clerk surprised me with an invitation to dinner at his house, which I happily accepted. I met him after work a few days later. As we walked to his home in Walworth, I commented on the many rings on his watch chain. "Oh, yes," he said. "All gifts from clients. I always take their gifts. They're portable property." I noticed that as we got closer to Wemmick's house, he became more relaxed and friendly. When we arrived, he showed me his vegetable garden. Then he took me inside and introduced me to his almost deaf father, whom he called the Aged. "Hello, nice to meet you," cried the Aged. He was cheerful and bright, and I could see he and Wemmick cared about each other very much. Dinner was altogether enjoyable, and so was the walk back the next morning. As we went, though, Wemmick's face gradually became drier and harder until his mouth had tightened into a thin line again, and I remembered he had said at dinner, "The office is one thing, and private life is another." "By the way," Wemmick said, "Jaggers will be inviting you and your friends to dinner tomorrow, and he'll give you good wine and food. But listen, make sure to look at his housekeeper." "Why?" I asked. "Well, you'll see a wild animal tamed. Keep an eye out for it. It certainly won't lower your opinion of Jaggers' powers." Indeed, Jaggers was powerful both inside and outside of court. I remember once seeing him argue a case, and even the judge seemed scared of him. Jaggers did invite us to dinner. His house was filled with solid furniture, shelves of books, and a collection of wine bottles within reach beside the table. As we ate, he somehow drew out our worst qualities, and before long we were talking competitively about who was strongest. Jaggers seemed particularly impressed by Drummle and his rude manners. My guardian called him the Spider. The two of them were talking when the housekeeper came in with a dish. About 40, she was tall, with large, faded eyes and long, streaming hair. I felt she looked familiar, even as I noticed she always kept her eyes on Jaggers, which he seemed quite conscious of. Then, mid-sentence to Drummle, Jaggers suddenly grabbed her hand as she stretched it across the table. "If you talk of strength," he said, "I'll show you strength. Molly, show them your wrists."
"Sir," she murmured, "please."
"Come on now." Uncomfortable, she held her wrist out. "There's power here," said Jaggers. "Very few men have the strength she has." Then he let her go with a slight nod. He poured more wine and asked questions that somehow led us to argue with each other, until Drummle was actually about to throw his glass at Startop. Jaggers intervened and then suggested it was time to go home. On our way out, I apologized to Jaggers. He said he quite liked the Spider, but nevertheless advised me to stay clear of him. Fortunately, about a month later, the Spider finished his studies with Mr. Pocket, and we did not have to see him anymore. Around this time, I received a message from Biddy. Joe was coming to London with Wopsle and would visit me the next morning. I'm ashamed to admit I was anxious about how he would fit into my life in London, but I felt it was fortunate he would be meeting Herbert and not the likes of Drummle. When Joe knocked at 9 sharp, I opened the door to his bright, honest face.
How are you, Joe?
Pip, dear boy, how are you?
He shook my hand and then sat uncomfortably on a chair I pulled out. He told me that my sister was well, that Biddy was as sweet and helpful as ever, and that Wopsle had moved to London to perform in the theater. As he spoke, Joe looked uncomfortably around the room. Then, when Herbert joined us, he looked even more awkward. I introduced them, and we sat down to eat breakfast, talking in breaks and pauses. Joe began to call me Sir, coughing and dropping more food than he ate. I felt relieved when Herbert left for work. At the time, I did not understand it was my fault, that I felt impatient with him, and he could feel it.
Now that we're alone, sir, Joe began.
Joe, I interrupted crossly, how can you call me sir?
He looked at me quickly with hurt pride in his eyes. Then he spoke.
I have to leave soon, though I'm happy to see you're such a fine gentleman. The reason I've come is because Miss Havisham asked to see you, and she said Estella's come home.
My face flushed as I heard the news, and Joe added that Biddy had suggested he deliver the message in person.
But I've finished my business, sir, he said, standing up, and I wish you all the best.
But you're not going now, Joe?
I really must.
Our eyes met, and all the sir melted out of his heart. A heart I'd always thought was as strong as it was emotional, and he gave me his hand.
Pip, dear friend, life is made of ever so many partings welded together, and we all have different places where we fit. I fit at the forge, and you'd feel better about me if you thought of me at the forge. So bless you, dear friend.
Joe touched my arm gently, and then he left.